When I was in seminary, I took a class called Spirituality for Clergy with an amazing elder of the Lutheran Church. He had been Archbishop of Stockholm, Reverend the Bishop Christer Stendahl. And he began every class by praying. And this was the prayer that he always began with. O thou eternal wisdom, whom we partly know and partly do not know. O thou eternal justice, whom we partly acknowledge but never wholly obey. O thou eternal love, whom we love a little but fear to love too much. Open my mind that I may understand. Work in my will that I may obey. Kindle my heart that I may love thee. Amen. Now, I love signs and statements that have double meanings. Something where you can read in a meaning that maybe wasn't even intended. And for example, while I was at a training seminar the first part of this week, I was staying at a conference center outside of Baltimore. And next to the elevators, there was an in-house telephone, one of those old-fashioned black wall units just hanging on the wall, with a sign that said, in big capital letters, LOST? Dial zero. Now, I'm sure that sign was there because it's a big conference center. It has a north tower and a south tower. I was at the elevators of the north tower. I'm sure over the years they've had to help a lot of people get to where they were trying to go, and they made it easy to call the front desk. But some of you know that I arrived for that training feeling anxious and insecure, a bit spiritually lost, you might say. So I interpreted that sign on a more existential level, and it made me laugh out loud. I mean, really, through the course of your life, haven't there been times when you felt confused and alone and lost that you would have given anything for a sign like that that told you who to call? Lost? Dial zero. Or there's a wonderful story about the philosopher Peter Russell, whose answering machine apparently had a message that said, "This is not an answering machine. It is a questioning machine. Who are you, and what do you want?" In case you think these are trivial questions, they are not. Most people come into this world and leave it again without having answered either question. So it may not surprise you that my sermon title comes from another such message with possible layers of meaning. And now I refer to a story that I heard from a colleague of mine many years ago, who said he was driving along on the highway, and he came to one of those big highway overpasses. And on the overpass, some graffiti artist had spray-painted in big crooked letters, "What song are you singing?" Now, that could just be an unkind way of drawing your attention to that annoying song that happens to be stuck in your head. You know how that happens sometimes, right? Sometimes people refer to it as an earworm, which is, I find, a very unpleasantly graphic image. But, you know, it's that song that you can't seem to stop singing, no matter how hard you try, that gets stuck in there and just won't come out. Certain hymns will do that with me. And if it's a hymn that I like, that's just fine. There are hymns that I never choose to lead because I know I'll be singing them all week and they are not among my favorites. Companies pay people a lot of money to come up with songs like that to use in their advertisements, songs with hooks that get in there and stick. I can still sing by heart many of the commercials I grew up hearing as a child on television, and I'm willing to bet some of you can also. They still get stuck in my head more than 40 years after they stopped airing on television. But my colleague chose to hear that question, "What song are you singing?" as a much more profound question than "What stupid tune is stuck in your head?" And after he played with it for a while, he went on to suggest that our lives are our songs as we move through the world. We are singing with our lives. And the music that we put out there affects the harmonies of the universe. We need to let our lives sing. But then it really matters what song we're singing, because the world is going to hear it and be changed by it. Now, a lot of the time, I don't really pay much attention to what song my life is singing. Working on this sermon helped me to realize that. And it helped me to realize that one of the reasons I need to come to church is because here I'm reminded to be more intentional about how I'm living, about what my song is putting out into the world. So then I get to Psalm 96, and the psalmist tells me to sing a new song to God. And I have to ask what that really means. What does it mean to sing a new song unto the Lord? Now, of course, I'm using the idea of singing our song as a metaphor. But metaphors only work if we can relate to the literal experience that they're referencing. So let's stick to the literal for just a moment here. Because if the idea of metaphorically singing God a new song seems a little too vague, let's look first at what it means literally to sing a new song. Because I know about how well it usually goes over when you try to get people to sing a new song. I mean, not pointing any fingers, you guys are actually a lot more flexible than a lot of groups I've worked with. Mostly, we like to sing the songs we've always known. We like to sing the songs we know by heart. We like to sing the songs that we know speak to our hearts. There's an old chestnut of a joke about why Unitarian Universalists are so bad at singing hymns. And it's because they're always reading one line ahead to make sure they agree with the words. I don't think Mennonites are quite as cautious in that regard. But any time we're learning a new song, we are kind of checking it out, aren't we? Does it speak to our hearts? Does it say what we really mean? Do we feel comfortable singing this song? And learning new songs means we have to be just a little bit vulnerable. When I sing a new song, I might make a mistake. I hate making mistakes, for those of you who don't know that. I hate making mistakes. But when I sing new songs, I make mistakes. I might get the harmony wrong, and I take a lot of pride in my ability to sight read that alto line. You know, but if I don't know it, if the harmonies are different, I might get them wrong. If it's in another language, I might not be sure how to pronounce all the words. And watch out, if it's got a lively rhythm, you might even find yourself moving when you sing it. Or Harold, you might even smile. Well, not right, he's shaking his head. If it's hard to sing a new song in that literal sense of singing a new hymn on Sunday morning, for example, I think it's even harder to sing a new song with our lives. We have our habits. We like the way we do things, or even if we don't like the way we do things, we're so accustomed to them that it's hard to imagine doing them any other way. We think we've got things pretty well figured out. We've always done it this way, after all, and change makes us uncomfortable. But if we take the gospel seriously, we're confronted again and again with Jesus asking us to think in new ways, to try new things, and to open our hearts to new possibilities. Take this morning's gospel reading. The passage that comes just before the piece that Terry read is the Sermon on the Plain. Now, in the Gospel of Matthew, he gives the Sermon on the Mount, but in Luke, we're told he went to a level place to deliver these teachings. He has just delivered some really radical teachings to his followers. He has just told them, "Blessed are you who are poor," in a culture where it was assumed that to be poor was to be experiencing the judgment of God. He was telling them to love their enemies in a culture where they had been taught an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. He was telling these people not to judge, speaking to a people whose religious laws included rigid systems of judging who was pure and who was impure at any given time. We don't often hear a whole lot about how people responded when they listened to teachings like this, but I can imagine that his disciples are a little shaken up at this point, wondering who on earth this guy is that they've decided to follow and how they are going to take in all of these radical new ideas. And just prior to that sermon, he had been associating with lepers and eating and drinking with tax collectors and sinners and healing on the Sabbath, getting in trouble with the Pharisees for all these things. This new teacher of theirs does not stick to the old ideas and the old ways of doing things. So immediately after he preaches about loving our enemies and not judging, he's put to the test. He enters Capernaum and he's approached by a group of Jewish elders on behalf of a Roman soldier, a Roman centurion, a commander of soldiers, who is seeking healing for a slave that he values highly. We don't know why he values this particular slave so highly. Is it monetary value? Is he genuinely fond of the slave? One commentary I read pointed out that the word for slave is used 4 times in this passage, but in verse 7, the word that's used actually translates as child. So maybe this was a child, and that explains the depth of his concern. And when the story is told in the Gospel of John, the centurion is seeking healing for his own son. Maybe the centurion, who, as we learn, seems to be a reasonably decent fellow, just considers himself responsible for his slaves and cares about their well-being. We don't know. But the more significant thing here is this man's role in the community. Perhaps his followers, Jesus' followers, are just beginning to get used to the idea that Jesus reaches out to those who have been marginalized in their own culture. Women, poor people, those who are sick or disabled. That's a lot to take in already, but they might just be learning to sing that new song. But this is different. This is a Roman centurion. This is not a Jew, it's a Gentile. This is not one of the oppressed, but one of the oppressors. This is a man in power, a military man of the occupying forces, a man with power and authority. You could say the enemy. So first the centurion sends Jewish elders to plead his case with Jesus. Who knows, these could have been some of the very same people who were so angered by Jesus' ministry to those who were poor and outcast. They didn't like him reaching out to the riffraff, but they're willing to argue on behalf of this influential Gentile. One commentary read, you know, he scratched their backs by building the synagogue, so he wants Jesus to scratch the centurion's back. They lift up all the good deeds he's done for the Jewish people. Yes, he's a Roman, a military figure, the oppressor, and yet he seems to be a decent person trying to treat the people fairly. And Jesus goes with them toward the centurion's home, and then he's met by a second group, this time the man's friends, so Roman citizens, who bring a slightly different message, still requesting healing for his slave, but saying, "But don't come to my house, I'm not worthy to have you under my roof." But in the same breath that he declares his unworthiness, he also trumpets his credentials as a man of power. So when I first read this passage, I thought he was giving a really odd mixed message, saying, "I'm not worthy, but do this because I'm big and powerful and important." But there's one little word that changed everything for me, and I noticed, which translation did you read, Terry? Okay, so in the New Living Translation, this word is not there. But I think the implication is still there. It's not quite as explicit. In the New Revised Standard Version, what the centurion says by way of his friends is, "I also am a man under authority." He's drawing a parallel between himself and Jesus. We are both people of authority here. And I think he's doing that not to lift up his own authority, but to say that he acknowledges Jesus' authority. And the commentaries I read also pointed out that by excusing Jesus from coming to his home, the centurion was respecting the Jewish purity code that would render a Jew ritually impure if he entered a Gentile home. It was actually an act of consideration toward Jesus not to command him to come to his home. Now, that's not what I would expect from a Roman centurion. And I think that's the point. Nothing in this story is what we would expect. We would not expect the centurion to be so deeply concerned for his slave. We would not expect him to turn to this controversial Jewish healer for help. I was trying to come up with a parallel this morning, and the best I could come up with, John didn't think it worked, but I'm going to test it on you anyway. It's like Robert McNamara going to Daniel Berrigan and saying, help me out here. We would not expect the Jewish leaders to be speaking up on behalf of a Roman military man. For him to be so well regarded by those leaders, respected and appreciated. It's easy to demonize the Roman occupying forces, harder to remember that they were also human beings, some of whom were undoubtedly decent and well-intentioned people trying to enforce the rule of law humanely. And we would not expect a man in his position of power and authority to then say he was not worthy of Jesus' presence. But Jesus doesn't think in terms of who is worthy and who is not worthy. He recognizes faith in unexpected places. And he values it even more highly when he finds it in an unexpected place than when he finds it in the expected places. The word in the gospel, he says, Jesus was amazed by the centurion's faith. And apparently the word that translates as amazed is usually used in the scripture to describe the reaction of people observing Jesus and what Jesus is doing. Amazed. Jesus has that same level of amazement when he encounters the faith of the centurion. We see again and again in the Gospels the way that the Spirit meets people in all kinds of unlikely places. Now, Christianity has an unfortunate reputation for being more interested in obeying the rules than welcoming the Spirit. More interested in being clear about just who is not worthy, who does not belong, than it is in figuring out how to welcome more people in. That doesn't come from Jesus. That comes from the church, with a capital C. And here at Berkesey Mennonite, we join the many, many, many Christians who are trying to sing a different song. If we're serious about following Jesus, then it's not up to us to judge whose faith is sufficient or who is worthy. It's up to us to welcome all who come seeking, to welcome them both in their faith and their doubts, to welcome them whether they are wealthy or struggling, to welcome them regardless of their sexual orientation or gender identity, to welcome them regardless of their intellectual or physical abilities. We've said we want to do this, we even voted on it, but we're still learning how to do it and how to let people outside of these four walls know that that is the song that we are singing. We're actively working right now to figure out ways to connect better with folks who are not part of this little community we love so much, to get out there and meet people where they are, to widen our welcome. Next Sunday, Jennifer Morales will be here with us. She'll preach the morning sermon, and then she'll be with us during the Sunday school hour to help us think about this. She led a similar process with ministry team and team leaders, and it was such an energizing and inspiring morning. I really hope you will all come and be part of that opportunity to explore with Jennifer, who has a real gift for taking a story and bringing us into it in a way that helps us. She worked with the story of the loaves and the fishes, and that'll be the point of her sermon. She'll be focusing on that as the text for her sermon, and then inviting us to reflect on that as a metaphor for what do we have in our hands to offer. And our community connections team is also working really hard right now, exploring ways to reach out, to look at how we present ourselves to the world, what language we use, whether it really reflects the heart of who we understand ourselves to be and who we're trying to become. So we'll probably be proposing some experiments, some new ways to reach out and welcome people in. Now, of course, as we talk about changes and new songs and new ideas, we face the fact that already among us, we are all a little bit different, with differences in our preferences and what's comfortable for us. And new people coming in will bring their own kinds of differences. So if we're successful in widening our circle, things are going to change. And I can't tell you how many times I've done a lot of work going in and leading retreats with congregations and stuff. Now, this is more in the Unitarian Universalist world, but I can't imagine it's any different. I once took a religious education workshop when I was working in religious education, and our leader was a Lutheran. But she was leading this workshop for Unitarian Universalist religious educators, and she kept saying, "Now, I'm sure this isn't true of Unitarian Universalist children, but Lutheran children." And she'd go on to present some absolutely universal, challenging thing about children. You know, so I'm sure this isn't true about Mennonite churches, but in Unitarian churches, you hear people say, "Oh, we really want to grow as long as nothing changes." If we're successful in widening our circle, things are going to change. Every new person who comes in changes things. And if we think about the people who have come in the course of your membership here, think about the people who have joined and the way things have changed and how grateful we are for those new gifts and those changes. We can't be sure that we will all like all of the changes. And sometimes we're bound to feel a little uncomfortable. And I think that's good. Because we can fall into the trap of thinking that church is a place where we should always feel safe and comfortable. But think back a few weeks to Wayne's sermon about chaos. Church is at its best when it's dynamic and changing, when it challenges us as well as comforting us. We do need to be gentle with each other. I do think church continues to need to feel safe. We need to be gentle and patient with each other as we look at different ways of doing things. But faith isn't about being comfortable all the time. It's about trusting the Spirit, even in the midst of change and anxiety. Faith is knowing that God rises to meet us and journeys with us as we learn and grow. It's about walking with the disciples and realizing that the gospel includes all kinds of things we might not have expected. For me, faith is trusting that the heart of God is bigger and has more room than I can ever imagine. And sometimes it helps to remember that the very things that are challenging for us, for any one of us, could be the exact thing that is really life-giving and energizing for someone else. I once attended a music and worship workshop where one of our leaders talked about the importance of including lots of different styles of music on Sunday morning. She had clearly been working with people who felt that the classical Western canon was the only thing appropriate for church. But they were also saying they really wanted to grow and be multicultural and diverse. A little bit of a disconnect there. If you want to reach and touch all different kinds of people, you have to experiment with different styles of music. And she suggested that if a song came along that wasn't quite to our taste, we should try to be grateful that someone else in the family was being fed and trust that our turn would come. And that has helped me so many times. If there's something that's not really connecting with me, I think, well, it's probably connecting with somebody else who really needs that in this moment. And in 10 minutes, something's going to come along that I'm going to really connect with that might not be their cup of tea, so to speak. There's room for all of that. It's true in the literal sense when you think about a meal. It's true in the metaphorical sense when you think about a community. So what song are we singing? Is it a song of inclusion and openness and welcome? We are called to sing a new song, a song of creativity and possibility, a song that leaves room for new folks to add their own harmonies and maybe even liven up the rhythm a little bit. It's up to us to fling our doors open wide enough that everybody who needs to can hear that song. And then it's up to us to invite them to sing it with us and be willing to learn their new songs too. Amen.